Welcome, everyone, to the Interpreter Foundation podcast. I'm Terry Hutchinson, one of the co-hosts for this episode. My other co-hosts are Kevin Christensen and Mark Johnson. Mark's got a technical problem going on and may join us a little later. But in the meantime, our discussion topic for this episode of the podcast happens to be an interview with Reed Nielsen and Scott. I want to make sure I get your name right, Scott Mariano.
Yes, that's right.
Okay. And let me just begin by saying that the mission of the Interpreter Foundation is to support the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints through scholarship. We make the latest and best scholarship available to you in podcasts, journal articles, books, seminars, films, and scripture roundtables. We invite you to see what the Interpreter has to offer at interpreterfoundation.org. Now, if you'd like this podcast, please tell your friends about it. Pop a five-star rating on. Give us a five-star rating if you like, or maybe it's a one for you. I don't know. You can subscribe, though, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Casts, Libsyn, or any other podcast app. Now, because the Interpreter Foundation is not owned or controlled by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, the comments we make are solely our responsibility. And I would encourage you, though, to donate to the Interpreter Foundation. It is a 501c3 corporation, meaning all of your donations are tax deductible. The finances for the foundation are available on the website. You'll see almost 100% of it goes to what you want it to go for. Nobody who works for the foundation is paid. And so there might be a couple of technical charges that they make here and there, but the staff, the president, the board, the trustees, nobody is paid. Everybody is volunteering their time because we feel this is a worthwhile effort. And when you surf the website, you'll see there's a lot of great opportunities and a lot of great content there. Now, as I mentioned, our discussion tonight is an interview with Reed Nielsen and Scott D. Mariano. And they have just released a new book from Oxford University Press called The Salt Lake Temple. And this book, I know it's out. You can get it on Kindle. I imagine you can get it on Apple Books, too. I haven't seen it on the shelves yet, but any minute now, maybe Reed, you and Scott have seen hard copies. In fact, I know that Benchmark Books has it because I just saw they announced that a few days ago.
Yes, it's out there. You can get it at all the major retailers that I'm aware of. It's on Amazon. I've gotten several copies myself, and Oxford did a beautiful job with the production values and the cover, and it's lovely.
That's a beautiful picture. I think I've seen that before. Who did that picture? By the way, I'm speaking to Reed Nielsen. So, Reed, why don't you introduce yourself and Scott? And then Kevin, you and Mark can also introduce yourselves. It looks like Mark's taking care of his technical problem.
Great. My name's Reed Nielsen. I'm currently the Assistant Academic Vice President at Brigham Young University in Provo. I had the opportunity there to work with the good folks at BYU Studies and the Religious Studies Center and the Neil Maxwell Institute for Religious Scholarship. Formerly worked at the Church History Library and Department, and that's where I came to know Scott Mariano. Scott?
Yeah, I'm Scott Mariano. I am a historian and archivist at the Church History Library. I've been there for over a decade. Got to know Reed, a great friend and scholar. While I was there, we lamented his departure, but he went on to do his mission presidency in Washington, D.C., and then to greener pastures over at BYU, but grateful to unite with him again here.
Well, that's great. Okay. Welcome, Kevin. Welcome, Mark. Hello.
Nice to be here.
Glad to be here.
All right.
No problems figured out. I was overclocking my computer for some reason. So.
Okay. I don't even know how to do that. I'm probably underclocking. All right. Well, we're going to get started here, and we'd like to rotate the questions for Reed and Scott and whichever of you kind of knows the most, but maybe Reed and Scott, you guys could tell us how this project got started and how it wound up at Oxford University, which is one of the more prestigious religious publishers in the world.
Yeah, I'd argue that it is pretty peerless, in fact. Oxford is remarkable. Their book list is extensive. And they have series on just about everything you could possibly imagine, including a wonderful religion book list. Maybe I could just begin by talking about the project. Since I was at the beginning, Scott really was throughout the entire thing, but really at the end, especially while I was serving a mission with my family. Back, I think, in 2017, was that the year, Scott? 2017? We still have the correspondence by email, but my religion editor at Oxford, who I'd published several books with, reached out to me and said, "We have a new series going, and I'd like to introduce you and put you in contact with the authors of this new series called Sacred Space or Sacred Sites." And they were supposed to be a series of biographies, much like you'd study the life of a person. They wanted to study the life of the most sacred space of the world's major traditions. And since I had worked with editor Cynthia Reed on several different projects, she was confident in my ability to help tell that story and put me in contact with the editors of that new series. Started out on the project and talked to Scott. He and I had worked on two other book projects together that were just remarkable experiences for me. Scott is such a talented historian and archivist. He's got just a killer combination there of not only a beautiful writer, but such a gifted archivist who understands the records and the collections and how they work together. And so we decided to once again collaborate. At that point, it went to a different religion editor at Oxford. And then COVID hit, a mission presidency hit, lots of other things hit. So that's why from 2017 now all the way to 2025, almost for a decade, we've been working on this project together. But we're delighted that Oxford would reach out to both believing and institutional historians to tell this important story. It would have broken my heart had they picked someone else, perhaps a critic or someone who didn't appreciate the sanctity and how we reverence this site in such a remarkable way. Scott, what other details do you have?
Nothing besides the fact that for the last decade we had a sort of a running joke between the two, a race to see which would complete first, either the publication of our book or the temple itself. And fortunately, we got a book out before a multi-million-dollar temple renovation completed.
Okay. So it was an invitation to do a series, kind of like the one Princeton's running with the lives of religious books, right? I mean, those are biographies. They've done an issue of the Book of Mormon, obviously, the one by I can't remember his name, Gutjahr. Is it
Yeah.
Paul Gutjahr? Yeah.
Yes.
In fact, Terrell Gibbons started to write that. There's a little story here. Terrell Gibbons has also done several projects with Oxford, and I was interviewing him on my radio show down in St. George, and he was telling me he started to do a brief biography of the Book of Mormon for Princeton, and then was reminded by Oxford gently that he was under contract with them for his next book. And so they switched his manuscript to the Book of Mormon, a very short introduction. And so he got it into that series. It was kind of shoehorned in there, but it sounds like kind of the same thing. So, as I've read the book, I've found several things about it I want to ask you about, but I'm going to let Kevin take a turn, and then Mark will have a turn too. So, Kevin, what's your question for these guys?
Well, and I just see like a great opportunity, and it looks like the right people were selected to do it. I think that's great. There tends to be what I call stones lighting up. when things unfold that way. Now, I've just glanced at the book, but I've noticed that it's the first several pages and the whole thing, it just looks like it's very, very well researched and detailed. And going into the personalities involved, the architects, kind of the motivations, the surrounding social circumstances, and then the period of time where they start building the temple, and some of the concerns about that. As you were writing the books yourselves, were there particular things that you'd uncovered or discovered that just enhanced your appreciation of the whole process of creating a temple, of building a temple?
Yeah, I knew the general contours of the Salt Lake Temple's history. It's been well plowed by researchers before, but as we dove into the sources, I gained a real appreciation for the human toll that constructing the building over 40 years took. We like to toss around the term in Latter-day Saint circles of sacrifice, and the building did represent that sacrifice. But once we got to meet the main characters, we could put a real human to that sacrifice. One that stood out to me was Truman O. Angel. He is on scene for almost the entire construction period of the temple. He's thrown into service by his brother-in-law, Brigham Young, when the original architect leaves town and never returns. And so he has to learn on the job how to construct sacred space from the ground in the middle of a new settlement, as Latter-day Saints are just starting to build up Salt Lake City and they've got other concerns. And he quickly learns on the job and adds some professionalism to it. But as you get to the end of his life, you realize he's not a rich man. He dies in the 1880s. He dies impoverished. He spends his entire career working on this building and never gets to see it to completion. Something else was driving him. He was committed to Brigham's vision to see the temple from the ground floor on up and was motivated by all the same tenets found within Latter-day Scripture to construct temple. That was the only thing that could really keep him on the job over the course of 30 some years.
One of the things I was surprised by was that story about him checking the footings and making sure they were level because they had a problem with getting the footings level. I mean, they had to redo it twice. But what was his technique? You guys write in the book about him. He apparently he's told the mason to check the level to make sure the footings were level using a certain technique, and the guy didn't. He used his own technique. And when they got a little higher up, they realized they were 2 inches off. What was it that Angel was going to do, or
Yeah, so this was the gift that Truman O. Angel unwrapped after the Utah War. Latter-day Saints are very familiar with the story of an army marching on Utah. They cover the foundation of the temple so that when the army marches in, all it represents is a blank field. Most Latter-day Saints had vacated the city. Brigham Young had essentially given instructions that if they meddle in our town, let's set Salt Lake City on fire. We're not going to let the army sit here. Well, it was a whole much to do about nothing. The army moves on further south. Eventually, they end up trading with the army. They profit from it. Most Latter-day Saints come back to the city. And Truman orders them to uncover the foundation. What he's inspecting there really is the top flagging course on what we would consider the temple foundation. The masons, he realized, had been using wooden rollers to slide the adobe blocks in place. And they're using mortar, a process called pointing, to kind of fill in the gaps. What they had used to help fill in those gaps was actually gravel mixed with some mortar, and they didn't fully point the gaps in between the stone. So much so that as they buried the foundation, it started to settle. And the foundation was out of level. So Truman comes in with others and he begins to measure the foundation. And he starts pointing fingers at the masons and say, "Hey, this is not the technique I asked you to use. We need to fully mortar these stones. And now we've got settling. If we were to drop granite blocks on top of this foundation, it's going to crumble. It's a sandstone foundation." So Brigham Young was understandably upset at this point. He orders that top flagging course and a couple other layers to be taken up. They don't end up replacing the full foundation, but it takes a couple years for them to get back to the place that they were prior to the Utah War. And now we see sort of a connection to the president pr or the present, where Brigham Young, in a sermon to the Masons and others, says, "Well, I would be hard pressed to have God accept a piece of sham work like this. We expect this temple to stand till the millennium." Well, now we see what we're doing with a major full-scale renovation. President Nelson shares the same sentiment as Brigham. That sentiment goes all the way through. We want this temple to stand to the millennium. It needs to be made of the best materials with a sure foundation. And of course, Truman was on site to make sure that happened.
at least now we have more money to do that. Mark, what's your question?
First of all, congratulations, gentlemen, brothers, on the book. I think it's a great accomplishment. It's good looking. It's thorough. It's fun to read. I've been enjoying
Thank you.
it.
Thank you.
Two things I've noticed are there's an ample amount of pictures in there. Some of them I haven't seen before. Is that correct? You have new things, or some of them are certainly rare photos, like the first one of the book of the photo of the dedication, or no, the groundbreaking. I'm sorry, I hadn't seen that one before. That's kind of cool. And then secondly, my other thing I can help you guys talk about, and maybe that's just due to the nature of this the project, this biographical, biographical outlook and approach you've got. The chapters are dedicated or talking about, like, the temple as an imagined place, a center place, a developing place, kind of going through the history of the temple based on these ideas. And then some of them, I don't know if I would have thought to put in there, like an administrative place or a political place. How did you come about with this approach of seeing the temple as, part of its history as seen as different places?
Maybe I can start on this one. I think the photos, I'd like to give the credit to Scott on that. As an archivist there in the library, he was so close to all the different sources, and I think really scoured a variety of collections to come up with photographs that would really enhance and that might bring something new. And so hats off to Scott for the images that he picked. And we're very grateful that Oxford allowed us to put over a dozen images in the book. You know, with printing costs these days, it seems like they're letting fewer and fewer images into to most monographs like this. And so that was great. Perhaps Scott can say more about that in a second. In terms of the different categories, one of the things that we wanted to do was to get the Salt Lake Temple out of the 19th century. The editors at Oxford were very clear that they wanted a biography kind of its lifespan, not just its construction. There have been many books written in the church by wonderful authors that have been very popular that really trace the beginnings of the Salt Lake Temple from the early 1850s, or 1847, when Brigham Young points out where the temple's going to be, to its construction dedication in 1893, and then the story kind of ends. Well, we knew that more than half the book had to be after the dedication of the temple itself, and that's where I think this volume makes the most contributions. And so you mentioned po political place or administrative place. That actually happens to be one of my favorite chapters, administrative place. I think one of the real insights or contributions of this volume is the story that we try and tell of how the temple, in a sense, exemplifies the apostleship, that it's almost a granite manifestation of the holy apostleship, priesthood, keys, and authority, and how the Lord's kingdom is organized on this earth. You look at everything the temple does, and it's really built on this notion of prophetic keys from the laying of the cornerstones in 1853, and that whole experience that we're able to narrate all the way to the very end, where we talk about how it has become the central administrative place of the church in terms of canonizing new revelation, or making the temple film available in more languages, or other administrative things that happen there in the temple. The revelation on the priesthood in 1978, I think this volume does a very helpful job of explaining why the temple is the central seat of administrative power and authority in the church. And one of the things that Wilford Woodruff says in 18, I think it's 1893, he says, "This is the temple of temples." In other words, it's not just kind of one of the temples. This is the granddaddy of them all, if you will. And today, certainly, that's how it functions. And we do go into a little bit of the story of how the Salt Lake Temple and the St. George Temple, there was a little bit of tension at the turn of the 20th century, as there was different administrative views on how certain things should be handled. But eventually, particularly under the presidency of George F. Richards, the Salt Lake Temple takes its place as the primary seat of administrative innovation, of doctrinal purity, of the practices, the standardization of temple ritual, etc. And that's one of the things that I love about the way the book is divided up, is we try and look at different aspects of its personality or function, or the way that it's been used by both church leaders and by Latter-day Saints over the ensuing decades since its dedication in 1893. Scott, what else would you say on that?
Yeah, one of the questions we wanted to answer is what is sacred space? And of course, that gets into a whole academic realm, and you could push theory out there. But one of the places we settled there was that sacred space in Latter-day Saint history also required people to make it so. It wasn't just about constructed space, it wasn't just about a building. But Latter-day Saints had to put their own aspirations there. They had to worship. They had to respond to prophetic revelation there. And that means that the Salt Lake Temple performed different functions in different times and periods of its history for the people that entered there. If I might just read one paragraph from the introduction that frames this idea. We say the Salt Lake Temple also developed from the Latter-day Saints' quest to house the literal presence of God and to receive frequent divine revelations. More objectives developed over time, and the temple grew into a cultural symbol, an icon of an entire people, and the heartbeat of a now global faith. The Salt Lake Temple remains simultaneously a place of institutional pilgrimage, church administration, missionary proselytizing, and historic preservation, all connected to the church's public image. The religious expressions of the Latter-day Saint people are as much a part of the temple as the granite harvested from Utah's mountains. So we did have to answer the question that Reed pointed out. What do you do with the space that's now dedicated in the 20th century? Only Latter-day Saints can enter. And so we wanted to engage with, well, what does it mean to the people? And how has that meaning shifted to the present day? And what justifies the massive renovation underway now? What's it going to mean in the future? So our last chapter there, called Media Place, kind of postulates, well, what does it now mean to a global Latter-day Saint faith with hundreds and hundreds of temples around the world?
Well, I kind of felt like this is more of an the story of the temple's interaction with the world, as opposed to the world's interaction with the temple. You do have a chapter called Contested Space, where obviously the temples are threatened by the actions taken by the federal government during the period right before the manifesto and then sometime after. But to go to your point, Scott, I mean, the example that you guys give in the beginning of chapter six, this public place where it's called public place, is a woman who comes to Temple Square in 1934, and her hand is, there's something wrong with her hand. She says, "I have faith enough to go away from this block healed." She came to Temple Square to be healed by her contact with the sacred space. And to me, that kind of gets to the heart of what you both are trying to accomplish with this. Would you both say that's the case, starting with Reed and then Scott?
Absolutely. One of the interesting things of writing with a secular university press like Oxford, and they were great to allow us, we let them know that we wanted to write as believers. We wanted to make sure that our faith came through. At the same time, you have to write in a certain way with certain language and kind of framing, so it's understandable to a non-Latter-day Saint audience or a non-believing audience, right? But I think that's something that was important to both of us, is that the supernatural or the manifestation of God's power, the miraculous, is not taken from it. It's not just a wonderful building that sits there on Temple Square, but in fact, people could feel and acknowledge and want to be close to it to feel God's power. In this case, in this woman's case, to be healed, to find something that was beyond just the normal temporal, I don't know, regular space that surrounds us so much. I think that's one of the reasons why we wanted to start with that first vignette about President Lorenzo Snow and his encounter of seeing the Savior, seeing Jesus Christ there right before he became president of the church, and him relating that sacred experience to his granddaughter, and what that story's become as a sort of a communal revelation for us as a people. And this was one of the challenges. We went back and forth with our editors at Oxford. How much of the sacred are we allowed to imbue, ironically, a sacred space with? And how do we tell that story in a way that others, our readership, a very non-Latter-day Saint readership, again, this is written not for Latter-day Saints specifically, but for a larger religious studies audience. But we wanted to make sure that people knew what we felt the temple was. And so that's why we began with that story of the Savior. That's why we included stories like this woman wanting to have her hand healed, and many other experiences that allows our faith and our witness to come through in ways that I think will still resonate with those that may not share our faith. Scott?
Yeah, I'll just add that one of the challenges and opportunities here as we're writing about that topic, and Terry, I love that you brought that story up because it represents one of our approaches is we can capture what the hierarchy is doing, what church administration is doing surrounding the Salt Lake Temple. We have a story of the blessing of Spencer W. Kimball in there, for example, where this really sweet moment where the Quorum of the 12 gathers prior to his heart surgery to give him a blessing because they believed that the temple held healing power. Well, lay Latter-day Saints as well believed that, and non-Latter-day Saints hoped for it. And so they took pilgrimages to the sacred space to benefit from it. To Reed's point, we start the book with Lorenzo Snow seeing the Savior in the Salt Lake Temple because Latter-day Saints were told and believed that they could manifest divine presence in the house of the Lord. It was supposed to be the literal house of the Lord. When Brigham Young gives his address surrounding the cornerstone ceremony, he says, "We are going to build a place for Christ to lay his head." That was the repeated refrain. He's paraphrasing Sidney Rigdon from the Kirtland Temple dedication. So they were constantly on this quest to manifest divine presence in the house. When they go to dedicate it, they are looking for signs that God has accepted it as a house of the Lord. Wilford Woodruff, the prophet at the time, tells them to look for those signs. They are hoping that he would accept it as his house. And the multiple dedicatory sessions contained spiritual manifestations where Latter-day Saints collectively felt that God had accepted it and they were going to find him there. So Lorenzo Snow becomes one manifestation, one proof to Latter-day Saints that yes, he has accepted it and he does dwell here. God's presence is in the center of the American West in Salt Lake City, in a granite temple carved out of the mountains. That was their quest.
Kevin?
Yes, I was just when you're talking about this idea of manifestations. Now, I guess 52 years ago, when I was getting ready to go on my mission to England, they took us into the upper room of the temple and to have a question and answer session with President Lee, who was at the time was the prophet. And so we were all dressed in our temple clothes, so in the sacred space in the upper room, and we all felt him enter before we turned and saw him walk up to the front. And this time, I had a brother on a mission in Santiago, Chile. And right at that time was when the coup against Allende was taking place. And there's no word getting out. We just know that there's violence and people being disappeared. And he walked up, presently he walked up and he said the first thing that he said was that the brethren had prayed for the safety of the missionaries, that they'd be safe. And at that moment when he said it, I felt this like this electric shock go from my feet up out through the top of my head. And I knew my brother was safe. Talking about it later, because they could hear machine gun fire at nights and they had like the bomb runs against the Capitol that were going right over the missionaries' headquarters, so it was a dicey thing for us, but I felt that I had that sacred experience there in that place. And I've always noticed that the Salt Lake Temple in particular, when you refer to, I like your phrase, the Temple of Temples, it's become an iconic symbol of our people. Throughout the world, you show that building and it's can't be mistaken for any other building, and it just points directly to us, and it just manifests itself as, yes, this is a sacred space, this is a rampart against the world, this is a place. The first chapter you say tells that story about seeing God face to face. This is the house of the Lord, he's been here. So I think then this book is going to fulfill a wonderful service for people who want to really get a grasp of the what the building's presence has literally accomplished. So congratulations.
Well, thank you. One thing that was interesting, let me speak to this, because that opening vignette with Lorenzo Snow, I think, is such a powerful way to begin the book. As you're all aware, these books go through peer review, and I at the time you don't know who the peer reviewers are. They don't always let you know. And there was some very critical writing about, now wait a second here. You're really suggesting that Jesus Christ actually appeared to your prophet, and can you really write that story? And what document, what proof do you have? And what have historians said about that? And we got a fair amount of pushback about that particular passage, but we felt that it was important to keep in. Again, it's very interesting writing up such a sacred story for a non-sacred press, right? I mean, Oxford is, it's a secular academic press. And it was very interesting to see what we were able to do, and what things they really wanted us to pare back on, or to include that we weren't comfortable to include, such as the temple liturgy. We made it very clear up front that there are things that are dear to us that we've made covenants, and of course we didn't use covenants, we promises or understandings that we don't include. And they weren't always happy about that, but to their credit, they backed us and said, "Hey, we appreciate the sacred nature of what you're talking about, and someone else can write that other book, but that's not this
As a
book."
matter of fact, we're interviewing him in 2 weeks.
Well, again, I'm not referring to anyone in particular. When we wrote this book, of course, this was many, many years ago, but we decided that we were going to not write about certain things. And in fact, when Cynthia first invited me to write the book, I was thrilled, as I mentioned earlier, that they reached out to a believing institutional historian. But I said to Cynthia Reed, who has since retired from Oxford, I said, "But Cynthia, there's just certain things we won't, or I won't write about." And she was very understanding. After she retired, we had another editor who then came on a little strong, and we reminded them of the earlier conversations and the promises that we'd been made to not have to divulge things that are sacred to us. And I'm very grateful that Oxford was true to their word and allowed us to do the book we want to do.
Mark, you might have a question.
One of the things that you cover in the book is, and I think this will be interesting to a lot of the readers, especially Latter-day Saint readers, is James Talmage's writing of his book, The House of the Lord, in the temple. I'm wondering if you can give us some of the readers a little sneak peek about what they'll find when they get to that section.
Yeah, that's a fun story, and one that some Latter-day Saints know and many don't, in that it is one of the most crystal clear examples of when the sacred boundaries around a temple, preserved by the recommend process. Latter-day Saints have to present a recommend to a desk. They did back in 1911 when this instance occurs. But essentially, Gisbert Bessard and Max Florence, two locals, one a convert, essentially breached through the assistance of a gardener the temple doors at night. And they go through and they take a ton of photos of the interior of the temple, thinking that they could market them. They're sitting on a gold mine. And this is playing into a notion that is pervasive at the time in American culture. What do Latter-day Saints do in temples? We still get asked that by our Christian counterparts, and the church is answering that question much better than they did back then. We had other concerns. So they take those photos, they run off with them, they blackmail the church essentially with them and say, "Hey, we're going to put these photos out. If you don't pay us a certain amount of money to keep quiet." And the prescience of Joseph Fielding Smith shows through at this moment.
Joseph F.
Or Joseph F. Yeah,
Right.
he's a Joseph Fielding, but he's not that Joseph Fielding. Joseph F. Smith shows through here, where he says, "Go for it, have at it." So those,
It didn't sound like it was prescience. It sounded like make my day.
yeah,
I mean,
trying.
Joseph F. was a tough guy. I mean, he herded cattle across the plains. You're not messing around with that guy or you're going to get hurt.
Yeah, so these two head to New York and they start putting together a show, essentially, to display these photographs. At the same time, James E. Talmage is commissioned to write A House of the Lord, a book that most Latter-day Saints know and have read. And if they've gone on a mission, they probably carted around. And And they include photographs of the interior of the Salt Lake Temple professionally taken. We display some of those C.R. Savage photos in the book. And they release essentially their own photographs that are much better than the kind of darkened photos that Bessard and Florence have, and essentially undercut the show. And one of the missing elements that we write about in the book of their show was essentially, it's not just the rooms of the temple that matter to Latter-day Saints. It's the ordinances, it's the rituals there. At some point they realize this and they start to recreate temple garments, and they try to show photos of ritual, but for the most part, Americans just didn't care. And they make no money off of this. Meanwhile, House of the Lord is one of the most popular and celebrated books in Latter-day Saint culture.
One of the things I love about this story, as a scholar myself, and as a believer, and as a just a regular Latter-day Saint, I love when the brethren look to scholars. You know, here you have Joseph Fielding, or Joseph F. Smith, as president of
I
the church,
got you,
looking
Reed.
to look. You got me now. Looking to a scholar in James E. Talmadge. You know, he was a geologist, a PhD, one of the first graduates of Brigham Young University or Academy. At the time, a great scientist, and I just love this idea of by studying by faith, bringing the secular and the spiritual together, that the brethren could call upon great scholars to do great things for the kingdom, and that James E. Talmadge was in a place both mentally and spiritually where he could bring to bear his faith and his great talents, his intellect, and bless the church. And I just love when those things happen.
All right. So one of the things I think that you touch on in the book, but maybe not, is the workers. I noticed that when the Salt Lake Temple started, there were 60 to 90 people. And one of the things that I found interesting about what you brought out is how the number of endowments per day increased over time. I mean, before it closed, how many temple workers were there in the Salt Lake Temple? For example, in Timpanogos, we have 4,200. And I've got friends down in St. George in the old temple and in the new temple presidencies, and they've each got 2,400 in that work. Now, granted, they don't do full shifts, they do shorter shifts. But did you guys find out that number during your research?
We did not get an exact number of temple workers for the modern capacity, but we did get a sense and appreciation for why the temple evolved and changed, including its footprint. Just about every interior change of the temple was driven by two things. One was, how can we get more people into this space? Or two, this space is aging and we need to shore it up and improve it. This is completely in line with what President Nelson has approved and said about the temple today. Why are we completely reoriented the interior footprint of a historic temple? Well, it's to accommodate more people. It's to accommodate language sessions. We've taken out the live endowment. Now we're going to show it by video only. Something that many people cherished and will lament, but justifies a massive renovation. How do we get more people into the temple? So in the 1920s, they're concerned with that question. George F. Richards is thinking about it. How do we get more people through this building? Let's change the locker room spaces. Let's change the annex. Let's change the flow into the temple. The 1960s is the same way and onward. Just about every expansion and reorientation of the temple footprint is designed to accommodate more Latter-day Saints who are flooding into the Salt Lake Temple in particular, and not just their local temple. So how do we expand the capacity of this temple is the question they're constantly trying to answer.
Okay. So for each of you, what was it during this period of time through all your research that what were some of the things that surprised you that you learned? I mean, both of you are full-time church historian employees, essentially. Yeah, agreed. You went on a mission. Now you're at BYU. But before that, you were in the historical department. You guys look like you know it all. I'm being facetious here, but I would just say, what was it that surprised you as you did all this research?
Reed, do you want to handle that one first, or
Yeah, I'm thinking about
I'll give you less time to think.
Yeah, I'm thinking about this. I think for me, perhaps for me, what struck me the most through kind of the life cycle of this book, and it wasn't just the writing of it, but it's the production time until now. So from 2017 till 2025, I think has been not only the primacy of the Salt Lake Temple, but with President Nelson's recent focus and emphasis on temples and his announcement of literally hundreds of temples is just how our Father in Heaven is trying to bless his children through temples, whether it be the Salt Lake Temple or the early Kirtland Temple or whatever it might be, how he wants to literally bless his children and the cost of that. There is a cost, there is a sacrifice. We were talking about that earlier to the in the lives of those early temple workers. It amazes me what was asked of the early saints in Kirtland and in Missouri. We've been studying that in Come Follow Me over the past few weeks, and how the saints were blessed when they followed the command to build, house of the Lord, plural. And what that meant, and that same commandment was given then immediately within days of coming into the Salt Lake Valley. And Brigham Young and his prophetic successors spent so much of their time and treasure and everything else to make that happen. And then their prophetic successors since, up to, what is it, over 350 built or anticipated temples. And just thinking, sometimes I think we buy into some of the ideas of secularization, and I think we don't always think, maybe as a people or just as Americans, of just how real our Father in Heaven's promises are. We talked about recently about the second coming of Jesus Christ. That was one of the lessons that we studied in Come Follow Me. And I realize I'm getting a little more devotional, but that's okay, right? This
Well,
is the
for our
important.
format, yeah, we won't tell your editor till it's too late for him to do anything about
This
it.
is the Interpreter Foundation. I think we're okay here. But this idea that we actually believe Jesus Christ is going to come again, when you stop and think about that, that is mind-blowing. And it's exciting at the same time. And it's wonderful. And it's motivating. But it's also contrary to everything we hear and see around us in secular society. And this idea that a loving Father in Heaven would have us create sacred space where his son might manifest himself to its leaders and to our fellow lay Latter-day Saints, that we're commanded to seek the face of Jesus and to go to holy places to be close to him, and to have a prophet who recently has said that the greatest thing we can do to prepare for the second coming is to spend more time in the temple and to receive personal revelation and become more sanctified there. That's a remarkable thing, and it runs completely contrary to everything that we experience on a daily basis around us, right? And so I think that the big takeaway for me, as I saw this temple being built in the book in my mind's eye, and then outside my window there at the church history department, I saw it every single day outside my window, that spectacular Salt Lake Temple. I thought, this is, it's a manifestation, it's our exclamation point that the sacred continues, that it's real, and that someday this Jesus Christ will come back to his temple in very real ways, and that his prophets and apostles will continue to help lead and guide and prepare people ultimately for his final second coming, and that the Lord requires that sacrifice throughout all of the restoration and anciently. And I don't know if I'm articulating it well at all, but it's just a reminder to me that we live in a sacred world that happens to be secular, not vice versa. That this is the temple is real, and that power is there, and the keys and authority have been restored, and they reside with those servants that administer from that sacred place, but that ultimately it's his house, and he's declared that it's his, and that he's accepted of it, and that we can become close to him as we worship there or in other associated houses of the Lord around the world. So for me, it was just a greater appreciation of temple building globally, not just here in the Salt Lake Valley.
Well, thank you, Reed. How about you, Scott?
Yeah, I love that answer, Reed. I'm glad I forced you to go first. One of the things that both touched me, surprised me a little bit, because I thought I knew the temple somewhat as I dove into the research, was its ties back to Joseph, Joseph Smith. Joseph Smith, of course, dies. He's martyred in 44. Just as temple rituals being introduced, and Brigham's left to take it forward, they finish the Nauvoo Temple. They initiate as many people as possible before they head west. So Latter-day Saints had some understanding of what temple was and what the endowment was and what sealing was. These things Latter-day Saints now know intimately and have experienced multiple times, but they didn't know a ton. So how do you carve sacred space out of the dust, essentially, as you're building a new community, and build another temple after the traumatizing loss of two others? Of course, Kirtland they leave behind. The Nauvoo Temple burns before they've really even started anything on the Salt Lake Temple. And they're forced to confront that reality of we've lost two. Now we've got to build another one, and we've got to rally community support to do that. So we see signs of Joseph Smith in the early designs of Truman O. Angel. You see iconography of Willard Richards and some of these early founders in the church, and we see the intent to drop Joseph statues in little areas outside the Salt Lake Temple. Of course, as they near completion of the interior, they add stained glass window from Tiffany Glass of the first vision. There's other monuments to Joseph in this temple. And so the exterior design of the temple, and sometimes the interior design of the temple, was not just a monument to priesthood, but it was a monument to Joseph as well. It was a sign of the Latter-day Saints were essentially announcing, you're not going to move us again. We are going to drop a symbol of priesthood at the center of our community, made out of granite, the most solid material we can find from our mountains, and we dare you to try to kick us out again. We are not going to lose another temple. So, Latter-day Saints that waltz past the temple today and they take their photos for their wedding, it looks kind of like a Disney castle, and it looks romantic in a way, and it's gothic and it's medieval and it's unique to our iconography. We don't have a lot of other items like that. But for 19th century Latter-day Saints, it was their tribute to past loss. And it was a memorial to what Joseph had to sacrifice. And if you read some of the dedicatory session addresses, they share this kind of stuff. They put tributes to Joseph. So I gained an appreciation of that. What else does that iconic iconography, for lack of a better term, resemble to Latter-day Saints in the 19th century? And then what does it mean to the 20th century? For a global church that is announcing its Christianity to the world, that still has a prophet that is now 101 years old receiving revelation, but wants to share the Christocentric nature of our religion, in addition to this now really outdated but still iconic symbol of our priesthood, the first presidency, and of our faith. Those two things don't have to be juxtaposed. They can work together. So I'd encourage anyone that picks up the book to read our last section as we
Yeah,
theorize what did these
it's.
two symbols mean, and can they sit together in an era where we want to share our similarities with other Christians, but we have this really unique temple piece still sitting out that we don't want to dismiss because it's so important to our faith.
Well, thank you. That last section, I really enjoyed it about media. Starts with President Hinckley's tour and goes right up to the closure of the temple. We're all waiting for 2 years from now. I think anybody in the area who kind of has a story, I have a story with the guy who did the trees. He took all the trees out and they paid him an astronomical amount of money to try and keep them alive. We'll see how he does. It's taken a lot longer than he contracted for. And he was worried about it. And they said, listen, we know this may be impossible. We're just asking you to do your best. But Reed and Scott, thank you for being with us. I couldn't have summed up your interview better than with your last statements. So we'll let those speak for themselves. And for those of our listeners, once again, The Salt Lake Temple by Scott Mariano and Reed Nielsen is available. Probably it'll, I know it's a benchmark. I haven't seen it at the local Barnes and Nobles yet in the Wasatch Front, but you can get it on Amazon. You can get it on Kindle. I highly recommend it from Oxford University. Terrific project. Very good explanations of what you did there. And we want to thank you for being with us on this episode of the Interpreter Foundation podcast. So for my co-hosts, Kevin Christensen and Mark Johnson, I'm Terry Hutchinson. Thank you for joining us. And once again, thank you, Scott and Reed.
Thank you.
Thank you.